Blind Nil Audio.
Greetings, this is Carl. The conversation that you're about to hear is unique and highly personal for me. I know I've had my wife on, but my wife and I have had lots of conversations about money. In this episode, what you're going to hear is me talking with my oldest daughter, Lindsay. Lindsay recently turned 27. She lives in New York and she works in private equity. So her life is finance. She has been thinking about money and finance for a long time now. She did her undergraduate work at the University of Utah in a quantitative finance program. But that's not really why I was interested in talking to her. What I was interested in doing was to learn from her about her experience growing up with me as her father and all of the things that went on with money in my life. I know it hasn't been easy. My parents were divorced when I was 8. And really from that moment on, I felt insecure about money. And that insecurity shows up in different ways. I feel like there's always a lion in the bush. I'm hyper alert, especially when it comes to my wife and my children. Not that they need my protection, but I'm hyper alert about it. And Lindsay was the oldest. Lindsay was the one that really saw most of that during her life. You know, when we had tough times financially, as everyone does, Lindsay was the oldest. I wanted to see what that was like for her. So can I make a suggestion as you listen to this? I don't think you'll find the value of this conversation in the specifics. I think the value of this conversation is in the broad strokes of a father talking with his daughter about what really matters around money. I was also really interested in Lindsay's perspective on what we could have done better as her parents. Should we have included her in conversations earlier? What does she wish we would have done differently with the benefit of hindsight? So I knew that this episode would be deeply personal because it's my daughter. And of course, I want everyone in the universe to love my daughter. Let me just tell you a thing or two about Lindsay that will provide context for this conversation. So Lindsay has always been a rule follower. She makes lists of rules, which has served her actually really, really well. She's fantastic at making spreadsheets because they're rules that follow logic. And she is also one of the funniest people I know. And sometimes her wit can come across as dry, maybe even sarcastic, if you don't know her well. So you're going to hear some of that. Right from the beginning, actually, she talks about this experience with her mom and coins that is actually really, really funny if you know all the context behind it. So with that, let's dive into my conversation with the amazing, wonderful Lindsay Richards. So I'm pretty curious about why you signed up for this, to have a conversation with your dad about money.
Well, I mean, I like to talk. I'm curious about podcasting. I don't mind being an open book. I didn't see a lot of downsides, you know?
And what about the money part?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a topic that is like extremely difficult for me. So I wasn't like so worried. And also I know that you like to get deep on this podcast. So I was just like, if something is a little uncomfortable, I feel like that's almost good, but I'm also not that worried. It's not a topic that feels like super emotional to me. So I wasn't too concerned.
That's really interesting, actually. I have questions about that, but first I would just love to know, because I don't actually know the answer to this. What is your first memory of money?
That's a good question. I think two things come to mind, and I'm not sure which one came earlier. Actually, I'm pretty sure the earliest was we had to learn how to name coins in, I mean, I must have been in kindergarten because I believe we were in Salt Lake City, and I did not get a very good grade because mom wouldn't let me touch any coins. And, you know, so I got, you know, there's like the excellent and then there's like fair. I think I was at fair because I didn't know the difference between quarters and dimes. I wasn't allowed to see coins. So
what do you mean? I mean, maybe explain why weren't you allowed to see coins?
Yeah. So my mom's a little bit of a a clean freak. I mean, I don't even know if that's the right way to put it. Like, but she is. Like, she really likes things super clean. And coins, I think, are dirty. And she just really, it really bothered her. There were no coins in the car cup holder. We were not allowed to have piggy banks. Yeah, I mean, I just took it really seriously. Like, I didn't question it. I just said, you got it. I'll follow the rules. No problem. And honestly, like, even to this day, I don't love coins, but I don't have as much of a problem with them as mom did. But I also am like, I think I'll probably follow the same rules. Like, if I were to find a coin in a couch cushion, I might have to throw out the couch, you know? Like, yeah. We might have to, I mean, if not, like, at least a really deep sanitation. So, and also coins have become a little bit less relevant in our day-to-day life. So, Anyway, that's the earliest that I can remember money being a part of my life.
Are you less open to the law of attraction because you think coins are dirty? This is a question I've been waiting to ask for a very long time.
Am I the law of attraction, meaning that, like, I believe that I can manifest?
Not the hand wavy version of the law of attraction, but just, do you think coins are a little dirty somehow in our family's head could also mean, like, money is bad?
That's interesting. Maybe. I don't know. Like, if I really dove into it, then maybe. My first thought would almost be no, because coins are inherently not that valuable. And so I always thought that, like, us thinking coins are bad are almost us saying that we're too good for coins. You know? Like, we're not going to buy a quarter candy, you know? We don't need that.
We only buy dollar candy?
Yeah, we only buy candy that's at least a dollar. I mean, I know that, like, with inflation, this is almost totally irrelevant, and I'm not even that old, but I did grow up in a time where you could buy candy for less than a dollar.
Yeah.
You can put a coin in a gumball machine, and I was told to never do that.
Yeah, I used to be able to put a dime in a machine and get a full 12-ounce, you know, bottled Coke, red cream soda, Fanta red cream soda.
Yeah. I did think of another memory, though. It's a little later, but Grace and I, my sister, we were running a brownie operation and we were selling to the neighbors. And anyways, she was in charge of sales and I was in charge of operations. And I remember that you...
How old were you?
I don't know. I think we were probably like 9 and 7. I think they were probably turtle bars, like the caramel chocolate chip kind of bars. And they were good. Anyway, I remember that you kind of tried to explain to us that we would make any extra money. Like, if we made more money than what the ingredients cost, then we would make money. I think you were trying to help us understand profit, that not every dollar we brought in was actual profit. Some of it was...
And cost of goods sold.
Yeah. You're trying to make sure we understood that, like, the ingredients didn't just get here for free, even though to us they did. And I remember that at the end we did a little calculation and we made no profit. And I was pretty bummed.
Yeah.
We should have sold at a higher price. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. I remember that. What do you make of the relationship, how you and Grace viewed things differently there? Like, I remember Grace being very, like, profit-driven.
Yeah.
I'm doing the sales. Like, what do you make of that? What's your recollection of that?
I don't know. I've never really been, like, so concerned about maximizing the money input. For me, it was just about the process. Like, I liked the idea of, you know, figuring out how we were going to make this work. And yeah, the operations were very fun. I like to bake. Like, I wanted to keep everything organized. Like, that's what I cared about. The actual money, I don't know. Like, I kind of just figured that if we felt like we deserved $10, you guys would make sure we got $10. It didn't really matter how much we actually brought in.
Uh-huh.
And so I wasn't too concerned. I was a little jealous of Grace's sales skills. And I mean, I still am today. But I accepted that we had... You know, if we switched roles, it would have been worse for both of us. So
that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Do you remember what socioeconomic class you were in like junior high?
Yeah. Yes.
Tell me a story about that. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I've always been pretty aware of status, for better or for worse. I think, so we moved to Park City when I was in junior high. And I would say that I knew that Park City was a wealthy community, and I knew that we were not the wealthiest, but that we were probably, I mean, we felt middle class in Park City, but Park City is an upper middle class area. So I mean, I've just always, I would say for as long as I've known, I've considered myself upper middle class or lower upper class, like right on the edge of those things. I mean, I didn't feel super wealthy, like that's for sure. Like we didn't get whatever we wanted, but neither did really any of my friends, even those who were extremely wealthy, because I think there was this sense of like, we need to, there was definitely a little sense of like, we need to make sure that people don't know like just how much money we have, because it's almost kind of cool to like, if you just get whatever you want, that's not so cool. But
you mean like among your friends and people you hung out with, there was that sense?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But I mean, it's not, I mean, it doesn't seem so serious looking back on it, but
yeah. Did you have any experiences where you remember being like, oh, those people have a lot less, or oh, those people have a lot more?
Not a lot in high school or middle school. More now that I'm like in the real world, I definitely see like a little bit more the discrepancies between people. When I first went, the first time I can remember realizing that some people had a lot more was when I went to the London School of Economics, and it was the summer program, and everybody had come from really high-end schools in the US. So, you know, there were students from Princeton, a lot from University of North Carolina, Berkeley, like really good schools. And a lot of these students, I remember, just had so much money. And they were, I don't even know if the dollar value was that different, but the way they were spending it was very different. And that was the first time I realized like, okay, wow, like I didn't grow up around that kind of wealth. Like that's different.
What did you make of that? Like, what do you remember thinking when you had that experience at London School of Economics?
I mean, I thought it was kind of fun. Like, I was like, okay, this world's kind of fun. Like, I'm glad that this isn't all I know, but if this is where I end up, I'm not going to be too mad about it.
What do you remember about my relationship with money and the conversations that you'd hear around the house?
I do know that for a long time, whenever I've talked about the kind of situation I grew up in, it's always been, oh, it fluctuated a lot. I was like, sometimes we were really rich and sometimes we were kind of poor, honestly. And I do remember feeling that way, that like, you know, like, okay, kids, get whatever you want at Whole Foods. And other times it was like, okay, kids, we're not shopping at Whole Foods anymore. We're done.
Really? You remember that?
Yeah, for sure. So it definitely fluctuated a lot. I don't remember personally being stressed about money, except for very briefly in 2009-ish when we had to cancel a vacation. I remember thinking, okay, this is maybe not so good. But like on a personal level, I was never like, oh no, we're going to lose everything. It was more like, okay, we're cutting back. Okay, we're going strong. And I was like, okay.
Tell me about the vacation. What was that?
I mean, I think I was 12-ish.
Yeah.
It would have been 2009. And I remember that we were at the climbing gym, because we'd kind of gotten into climbing.
Where were we?
In Las Vegas, right before we left Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I think sometime around that time I had quit ballet. I actually think that that was a money issue as well. It ultimately like wasn't a big deal, but I do remember being told that ballet was really expensive and climbing was less expensive.
That sounds like a trick.
Yeah, it kind of does. But I think climbing was like twice a week and it was like a group thing, whereas ballet, because I was 12, had started to get like more intense. Yeah. And we had a trip planned to the Outer Banks, and I was really excited because we were going with a family that had a boy that I had a crush on, and it got canceled. And I was pretty bummed. And I know it was canceled. Like, I knew it was canceled for money reasons, but that's not, I wasn't so worried about the money. I was just like, oh, what a bummer.
Really interesting. But did you know why we were cutting back so strongly in 2009? Were you aware?
I mean, I do now. At the time, I sort of knew. I remember, I mean, Las Vegas was such a stark situation. Like, I remember walking around and seeing all the foreclosure signs on houses.
Do you really? You remember seeing foreclosure notices on houses?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I definitely do. I remember, like, people moving out. I remember, like, you having a conversation with someone. I'm not sure who it was, but it was another dad. And you guys were talking about whether or not people had done something wrong. Like, was this their fault or was this, you know, the government's fault? And so like, I knew, but like I said, like I knew it wasn't good and I probably was a little stressed, but I wasn't worried that like we were, you know, going to end up in a really bad situation.
What do you think that mom and I should have done differently with money?
Look, I actually think that all things considered, you did a really good job. I mean, if you think about it, like, from what I can tell with me and my siblings, we have a relatively abundant mindset in terms of, I think all of us sort of believe that we're going to be fine financially. And that's kind of rare. You know, I didn't realize how many people really don't believe that. And so I actually think that's pretty amazing.
Hey, it's Carl. I was actually surprised about this part of the conversation. I was surprised at how tender this felt to me. And at the same time, how happy I was that Lindsay had managed to pull these lessons out of our experiences. Particularly, I'm glad upon reflection that my children, at least according to Lindsay, all feel, she used the word abundant. I would almost use the word safe. When she said, we're going to be fine financially, I don't think she's talking about anything like extravagant or luxury. I think she just means we're going to be fine. And if there was one goal that Corey and I had around money with our kids, was we wanted them to know they were going to be fine. I think one of the things every parent wants is for your kids to feel safe. And I didn't have that growing up. I never felt safe. There was never a sense of security or stability growing up. And that wasn't necessarily because anybody did anything wrong specifically. It was just because I didn't know. So I was really, really glad to hear this.
I do think the one thing that has always confused me, and now that I have my own money, I get it more. But the one thing that confused me as a kid, and I wish I understood better or had been different, was the pot. I didn't understand how come there wasn't just one pot. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, you can't have these new skis. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And then it's like, but we're going on this trip. And I'm like, okay. Huh. So the trip is 20x the cost of those skis. So can you just explain to me the pot? Because it always felt like there wasn't one pot. I do think some of the decisions were a little emotionally driven, of like, if we place extreme value on it, we will make it happen regardless of whether it's super financially reasonable. And if we don't place value on it, we're going to be super frugal about it. And so to me, I'm just like a little bit more practical. I want a number, you know, like, is okay, there's $1,000. We're spending this much on the vacation. And so there's this much left over. And if we divide it among the four kids, you each get $100. And I'd be like, okay, cool. I'll figure out what to do with that, you know? But I know it's not that simple, especially because your job was not like, it's not like you made a consistent paycheck every single month where you could know exactly what was coming in.
Yeah, but maybe we could have involved you more actively in the mental accounting that was going on in our minds.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like, wait, I don't understand how come dad just got a new whatever, or how come there was a new computer that showed up, or even like, or exactly what you said, like either trips versus something else.
Yeah.
There was not always, there are plenty of times where that was just like, we weren't thinking, it was just emotionally driven. But there are other times when we thought really carefully about it and we could have done a better job. It's when do you wish you would have been included? Like as early as often, as early as possible?
No, not as early as possible. Like I said, I really feel this way. I think that when you are inherently like a rule following child, you don't need a lot of information about the bad things. Right. You know, like the DARE program was not for me. I didn't need to know what drugs were out there. I never was going to do drugs, but now all of a sudden I'm wondering, am I going to be a drug addict? I don't know. Like, I didn't need to know, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So I don't think that kids need to know all. Sometimes I'm like, for me, who wasn't thinking about these bad things, I'm not saying money's bad, but like, I didn't need to know that there were negative options.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think as early as possible. I do think probably like 14, 15 was when I was really starting to assess, like, you know, hey, I'm seeing decisions being made that I don't quite understand. And I would have liked to be looped in on like, hey, look, honestly, you know, like this trip just really means a lot to us. Like this is really important in terms of our family bonding, or like this place is really special to your mom. So we're making this choice, even it's not skis or trip. And also, like, maybe I needed a little bit of humbling in the sense of, like, this isn't all about you, Lindsay. You're not going to the Olympics. So calm down. Okay.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think so, though. But yeah. We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to 50 Fires. Do you now, like at the age you are now, would it be helpful for me to like show you our tax returns and kind of walk through how much money we made over the years? Like, would that be educational, helpful for you now?
I think yes. I think it could be helpful, but purely from the standpoint of one thing I really am passionate about is that I think a lot of people do not know how much money it takes to live like a certain lifestyle. And I think it could be helpful to say, like, okay, do you want to own a home? Do you want to own two cars? Do you, you know, like, what kind of home do you want to own? Do you want to take vacations where, you know, you're taking three kids for 2 weeks somewhere?
Yeah.
Because that kind of stuff, like, now that I have a solid income, I'm like, okay, if I make as much as I make right now and I am supporting a full family, which lots of people do, a lot of the things that I did growing up are not options.
Mm.
And so, like, what, you know, how do I bridge that gap? I struggle with the gap between where I'm at and how you get to wealth that allows you to really own a nice home. I could calculate what the mortgage would be on that, but like, how do I get that kind of cash? Like, how are people affording this that have normal jobs?
Yeah. There's a lot in the literature around this dilemma of sort of helping your kids buy a home in a nice neighborhood that they couldn't afford without your help.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like as a parent, that's like such, I mean, if you could afford to do it, that's such an incredibly valuable thing you could do for your kids. But the research around it is pretty mixed. And in fact, it's not really mixed. It's almost that it's actually not a really nice thing to do, because now your kids are in a neighborhood and maybe you help them buy the home, but the type of furnishings that go on in that neighborhood, the activities that those people are involved in, the trips they take, the cars they drive are out of reach.
Yeah.
How do you think about, like, you grew up and there's a lot of, I'm really curious about how kids are thinking, not kids, young adults like you are thinking about the gap between the activities, and I'm really largely just talking about like the inflationary gap at this point, like,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily like my parents had tons of money and we did all these nice trips, how am I going to afford that? But just literally like housing, you know, or maybe the better question is, I am curious, do you think it's going to be hard for you and some of your peers that grew up in a neighborhood and a town like this to live up to those lifestyle expectations?
Yeah, I literally think about this all the time.
Yeah, tell me what you think about.
The housing thing, I don't want to own a home right now, so I'm not thinking too much about it. But ultimately, like, when the time comes, I would love to buy it myself, you know, and or with a partner, rather than have it, like, there's lots of things I would love to have your help with, but I do agree, like, I think you really need to think about where you can afford to live rather than buying something with help that puts you in a spot where you can't really afford to be. I totally agree with that. I've started to notice that some of the boys that I work with, boys I grew up with, people on LinkedIn seem to know how to create extra wealth when their incomes are about the same as mine. That is like something I haven't quite unlocked. And it seems like maybe those are the people who are talking about buying houses. They're like, okay, if you just invest, you know, $1,000 over here and then you do this with it and then you'll have $3,000 and then you can like, eventually you have $10,000 and then you can buy, put a down payment on like a super small condo and then you rent it out to Airbnb and then you make more money. And it seems like there's some sort of wealth building situation that some people have kind of unlocked, but honestly, I don't always trust those people. So I'm just kind of like letting them figure it out. And I sort of just figure like when I want to buy a home, probably in my early 30s, maybe mid 30s, like I just figure my income will keep going up and it'll be possible. Yeah. Or my income combined with a partner's income can make it possible.
That thing you just described of like, I'll invest it here and I'll do that. And
yeah,
I have a term for that, and it's not the nicest term, but I sometimes call it success porn, where people are like waving their hands about these different, and it can be really frustrating because you have no idea if it's true. And you even hinted at like, I'm not sure I trust, but you always wonder like, is there a trick in there that I'm not understanding? You use the term unlock. Does that cause you, are you like, is that like angsty for you? Like, how are they doing it? Or do you just not worry about it?
A little bit. It's not so much the comparison piece. Like when I see that my friends have bought homes, I really don't care. I don't want a home right now. It's more like just general wealth building. I'm like, you know, I'd love to go to Europe. How can I have an extra $2,000? You know, like my current lifestyle, a part of it is that I live in Manhattan and it's just so expensive. But I know that a lot of my friends, because we're still early in our careers, are making about the same that I make. We haven't really got to the point yet where there's this huge gap between incomes. And so when I see that they're doing these trips or things like that, or I am like, wait. You know, like, yeah. I'm not like wishing I was you. I'm just curious how you made this extra cash that I feel like is beyond your base salary. And then sometimes I hear people talking about like, oh, you know, we made a bunch of money on Coinbase, or, you know, like, oh, we flipped an apartment, or we bought a home in Houston where it was cheap and then we sold it at the peak. And that's how come we got this like windfall.
Yeah.
And part of me, like recently, I never really had been too worried about that. But recently I have been thinking like, is that how you build real wealth? Mm-hmm. Like, is that the secret? Like these base salaries, they're good, but they're not amazing. So like to get to the point where you can afford a home, is that how you get there? Like you have to be doing these little tricks.
What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I know that I can like build wealth eventually, but it's like, it's not close.
Yeah.
So if you want to build wealth this year, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just to be kind of clear, a lot of those things that people point to and they have happened, you know, some of them are just selective memory. Right? Like you talk to gamblers who go to Vegas, they don't tell you about their losses.
Yeah.
So some of it's that, but there's other parts of it that are like, it did happen. And the risk is thinking that there's a saying that a rising market makes everybody a genius. In fact, one of my favorite sayings is don't confuse a rising market with skill. So you hear a lot of that lately. And you think like the risk is, of course, thinking that that's a repeatable strategy, when really to isolate out what of it was skill versus luck is really, really on a small sample size of one, it's impossible to know whether that was luck or skill and to stay super humble about it. But what you're pointing to is kind of important, that, yeah, income doesn't necessarily build wealth. It's asset ownership of some form. And the way to own assets is to get really clear as early as you can about how much you can convert from income to ownership of something, you know, ownership of a business, ownership of a diversified portfolio like the S&P 500, not like crypto bets. Crypto bets are all lucky. Anybody who won in that game, like more power to you, but it was luck. Like, don't think you should start your own hedge fund at this point. Same with real estate, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's so true. And it's just kind of crazy when you realize that like some people, like if I didn't live in Manhattan, like, could I afford eventually, like, in the near future, a small home in Houston? Like, yes. And then if I bought it at the bottom and sold it at the top, could I make a good windfall? Yes. But, like, you know, a lot, like you're saying, a lot of that is luck, or choosing to, like, be partially luck and partially choosing to be in a circumstance that I don't necessarily want to be in. So, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I've started to, like, notice, because I obviously, like, spend a lot of time talking to men who work in finance, and I've started to notice that a lot of them, like you said, like, own pieces of businesses, are actively, like, thinking about investing in things. And I don't think about that at all. And so I have started to wonder if I should think about it more.
You've mentioned that a couple times, that the men thing. Do you think, because there is actually some interesting literature around this.
Yeah.
Do you think that is because there's an innate skill, or do you think that's because they're much more likely to be slightly overconfident and talk a lot?
Yeah, no, it's definitely the second one. And it's also just cultural, and I don't have any problem with it. Like, there's nothing that's, like, gatekeeping me from that information, and the information's not even that good. Like, exactly what you were just pointing to. They might say, like, oh, I made money off Bitcoin, but, like, if I go buy a Bitcoin today, I'm not going to make the same money, because
Right. There
was just this crazy thing that happened, and you either got lucky or you got really unlucky. Like, every one of these, you know, that's the way numbers work. It's not like everyone can win.
Right.
If someone's winning, someone's losing. Anyway, but yeah, there is definitely, it's just like a cultural thing. I think I noticed this even in college, that, like, a lot of the guys were talking to each other about, like, how to get internships, and the girls weren't as much. And I think that it just sort of, like, self-perpetuates into, like, ending up with maybe a little bit more knowledge about, you know, how to get a good job, how to invest your money, what other people are, you know, where they're putting their excess income, that kind of thing. But like I said, I don't think that I'm locked out from it. I just would have to, like, opt in, because my girlfriends and I are not talking about that stuff.
Do you think that's changing?
Like, a little bit. I mean, partially it's just interest, you know, like, we might just not be that interested in talking about the same things.
Yeah.
I mean, some of this is all wrapped up in, like, they're talking about sports betting. You know, that's straight up gambling. Like, that's not particularly,
right?
Like, it's not a good money making strategy. But if you're talking about sports betting, and then you're talking about betting on the stock market, it's just like this whole overarching conversation. Whereas I think my girlfriends and I talk more about, you know, like,
you like things that matter.
I mean, we probably talk a lot about Taylor Swift too. So it's not like everything we're talking about really matters.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I mean, I have a few girlfriends who work in finance, and we talk about it a little bit. But for the most part, they're doing pretty much the same thing that I'm doing, which is just, you know, investing in mutual funds and funding their retirement accounts and that kind of thing. They're not doing anything crazy.
Yeah. There's a huge, like, gambler's fallacy, survivorship bias problem. And you mix that with, like, I think, a pretty documented reality in the literature that men are more overconfident, more prone to overconfidence. And there's a difference between being underconfident and feeling like you don't know, or weren't taught, or it wasn't your thing, which is something we need to continue to work to resolve, and being just adequate, appropriately, I would maybe even say humbly confident, versus, like, overconfident, which is what you see among all these hand-wavy people talking about all the things that they've done. And then you've got the survivor bias, which you were pointing to, which is, right, you're only hearing the stories of the people that won.
Yeah.
Nobody's telling you the stories of all the money they lost on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Unless they're writing a book.
And I mean, I think about it. Like, if I walk away from work and I'm like, wow, we just talked a long time about investing in cryptocurrency, I'm like, am I actually going to do that? And then I'm like, no. Or like, oh, we just talked about home ownership.
There's something really important going on here in this discussion about finding the trick to investing. And Lindsay said things like, I haven't unlocked that yet, or maybe there's a trick. And then here at the end, she's referenced, you know, my girlfriends and I talk about money, they're in finance, but we're not talking about doing anything crazy. We're just talking about funding our retirement and investing in diversified mutual funds. Nothing crazy. And I just want to really put a fine point on this. That is exactly what we should be doing. The idea that there might be some other trick or some other secret or some other key to unlock is almost always a fool's errand. Now, it doesn't feel like that, and this has been a problem for me my whole life. It doesn't feel like that because there's so many people running around waving their hands, making noises like they're the smartest people in the world when it comes to investing their money. But we don't know the details behind any of that. It's almost impossible. The numbers do not lie. It's almost impossible to decipher luck from skill in those examples, even if they did happen. And often they didn't even happen. It's just people telling stories. So I just want to really emphasize, there's this feeling, and I've heard this a lot from Lindsay's age cohort. There's this feeling that other people must know something. There must be some secret. And I'm telling you, the secret is there is no secret.
And so I do, like, there is, even though sometimes I'm like, am I missing something? I think about it and then I decide not to opt in.
Smart. Tell me a little bit about the trade-off you've made very intentionally, and you've mentioned it. You know, you could live somewhere that's much less expensive.
Yeah.
And be saving quite a bit of money. But there was some value that you're capturing that doesn't show up on the balance sheet necessarily by living in New York. How have you thought about that trade-off?
At first, I didn't. I just came to New York because I wanted to be here and I was curious about the world of finance in New York. And I knew I was curious. I think that's maybe the best way of putting it. I knew that I wanted an experience like this. Now that I'm here and I watch all my money go out the door, I do think now I've had to be a little more reflective on the value. And I think there's a huge non-monetary value that will, you know, that it's so, so worth it. Like, I find myself in rooms talking to people I would never, ever, ever be in if I lived literally anywhere else. You know, like, I show up to work and do you want to come to this happy hour? Do you want to go to this conference? Those things are so valuable. And I just think about the people I meet, like, these are people that I'm going to know for the rest of my life. Just being here, physically being in the center of the financial world, I think is so cool. Like, I am really, really, I think about that all the time. I'm like, I'm so grateful to be interacting with these people.
So now you feel like you're making a conscious decision between a set of trade-offs.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's totally, totally worth it. At least based on what I value and, you know, the choices that I've made.
So in your head, you're actually almost making it like this is an investment that will generate some return. It's kind of off balance sheet. It's like a personal balance sheet return in the form of what? Conversations, skills, relationships, experiences, that kind of thing?
Yeah. And I think it really depends on what I choose to do with my life, but it could also return in a monetary form.
Sure.
So we'll see. But I mean, that's so far down the road. Like, that's not how I'm thinking about it. It's more, yeah, like the professional relationships, learning how to interact with people, being in these rooms. I mean, I like walk away, you know, when I leave New York and like, I mean, when I come home or I go somewhere else and I'm talking to people, it makes me realize that what feels very normal to me here is not necessarily what everybody else is like talking about and experiencing. I'm just like very much in this silo. I talk to people who work finance every single day. Like, that was not the case when I lived in Utah or even when I lived in Washington, D.C. And because I like that, it's very valuable to me. I'm not necessarily saying that's valuable to everyone.
I love that. It's really interesting to see you making those calculations in your head.
I'm almost envious of my friends who know already that they want to buy a house and settle down.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I had this piece of me, which it's pretty obvious where it comes from, that was like, I need to know what else is out there.
What are you talking about?
Just like a little bit of vagabond, you know?
From your mom?
Yeah. I mean, just like this sense of like, I gotta go see. And it's definitely not the most cost effective character trait that I have. And I sort of figure, like, if I start getting the sense over like a pretty sustained period of time that all I want is to live in a, you know, comfortable condo and eventually buy a home, and I just want space and I want, you know, my family, like, that's all I want, then I'll go do that. But right now it's not, you know, yeah. I feel like I needed to see the other side of the coin.
Yeah. That envy thing is really interesting to me because I struggle a lot with this. Like we have friends and it wouldn't take long for you to guess exactly who I'm talking about, but friends that have lived in Park City for 20 years and they're typically in the dental profession and they go to the same office and they do the same thing each day and they've planted trees in their backyards and they've watched the trees grow and they've been like pillars of our community and they've made a real impact. And I really do mean it. Like I'm really envious.
Yeah.
And like, sometimes I wish I was like that. And then when I go talk to them, all they want to talk about is what we've been doing. Cause they sometimes wish they were more like we had been.
Yeah.
And my point is neither one's right or wrong.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting that you feel that way too. Cause it is expensive.
Yeah, it is.
Like we've traded some stability for experiences.
Yeah.
We often talk like, you know, the 4 years in New Zealand cost us a lot.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't trade it for anything. Like it was so valuable in terms of the return emotionally and physically and mentally. So valuable.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you think about your cultural or even religious upbringing and what it makes you think about in terms of money.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I've thought about this more having more of a comparison set being in New York versus like growing up where most of my friends belonged to the same religion that I did, or at least had like a similar situation. And I have noticed that among the people that I'm friends with in New York who have the same religious upbringing as I do, there is a sense of frugality that I do not see in my peers who are not from that religious upbringing, who, especially my coworkers and I, you know, like I know that there's not like this huge income gap, but there is a difference in the amount of money that we're spending. And so I think I'm a little jealous because it sometimes seems like they're having more fun. But I also value the frugality. And I know in a religious sense, when it comes to money, like we definitely, there is something to be said for the value of hard work and like making really conscious choices. Like I think I have always known not to spend more than I make. And pretty much everybody I know from a church community is in that same boat. I don't think any of us have credit card debt. And that's awesome. You know, yeah. I don't know if we're having as much fun though, I will say.
Yeah. I think that's generally true. I don't know if we're having as much fun. Do you think there's anything particular about your religious upbringing or culture that equated goodness with wealth or money or prosperity?
I almost feel like it's the other way around. Like there's something inherently good about not having a lot of money.
Not really.
About being really altruistic, giving away as much as you possibly can, even though that might not have been reflected in how people were actually doing. I feel like there was some guilt associated with doing really well financially.
This was one of the highlights of my conversation with Lindsay for me and for her mother, my wife, Corey, because Lindsay's answer about the role that wealth played in our culture surprised me. And I learned something, which was what I was after. I knew that if I went into this conversation curious about Lindsay's experience, as much as this was a dialogue back and forth, and there were things I was sharing with Lindsay, I wasn't really there to teach Lindsay anything. I was there to be curious and to learn what her experience was about. And this moment highlights why I think we should have more conversations about money. Because an opinion I've had for 20 years changed because of what Lindsay said. Like, she saw it a different way, which I hadn't considered. And I was positive I was right about the opinion I had. And it turns out I'm not. That there are other ways of looking at how our culture, particularly the LDS or Mormon culture, views money. Turns out there's other ways of looking at it. And Lindsay had a different way of looking at it, which has changed my mind. And how cool is that, to have a conversation with your own daughter and have your mind changed? Lindsay, tell me how this lands. I'm going to make a statement, and I want to just see how you react to it. How much I earn as an individual is an indication of my value.
I mean, I know inherently it's not true. You know, I think, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is my friends who are teachers and nurses who are providing so much value and are just the best of the best. And their income does not match. And it never will. And that's part of why those professions are hard. I do think that I care about how much I earn, and I care about how other people think about how much I earn. So I wouldn't say I'm above that, but I want to be.
How would you define enough?
Ooh, tough question. I always heard, you know, that there's like this sense of like, money does make you happier up to a point, then it plateaus.
76,000.
76,000.
That was the study years ago, but yes.
Okay. And I was like, yeah, I buy into that. Like, I'm just trying to get to like a really comfortable middle class, and then I'm good. And I don't know what is driving this, but I would say right now, like, I'm pretty incentivized to try and make a lot of money. So I don't know. I do know there's a point where, honestly, I think if somebody handed me $5 million right now, it would make my life a lot worse. So I don't know what enough is. I think I was actually talking to my coworker who was super, super driven to become wealthy in a way that's on a totally different level from me. And he was like, you know, somebody told me to pick a number. Like, I want to make whatever, $2 million and then I'm good. He was like, I didn't pick a number, so I'm just going to keep going. He was like, I know it's bad for me, but I didn't pick a number and I'm not going to. Wow. And upon reflection, I don't know if a number is the right thing, but I think a general sense is maybe kind of smart, because as I continue down this career path, like when you hit that point where there is plenty, should you ever be so lucky to get there, you do have to sit back and say, why am I still doing this? Or like, should I readjust my expectations? But if you just have this infinite ceiling, I think, you know, you could spend your whole life chasing something you'll never get.
What do you said, I don't know what's driving this, but I'm feeling pretty incentivized.
Yeah.
What do you think's driving it?
I think there's a few things. I think there are some things that I know that I really enjoyed growing up that I know are expensive, such as skiing. And like, I want to continue to be able to do that. And I want to give that to my kids. And I just think about the household income would have to look for that to be like really comfortable. And I'm like, okay, that's, you know, that's going to take some work. And second is like creating something really comfortable for my kids and having been able to give them opportunities to do, you know, things that sports that might be more expensive. And then I think the third piece, which is maybe the piece I need to evaluate for myself, is just living in this silo of a lot of investment bankers. Like, people around here make a lot of money and they love it, you know? And there's also a culture of like buying, I mean, this not so much in among my friends, but I hear about it a lot, of like, oh, we're going to rent out a club for someone's birthday party. It's going to cost $2,000. Or, you know, we're going to the Hamptons. It's going to cost, you know, whatever, several hundred dollars per person. Like, that's not uncommon for people. I know I'm super siloed. And so I think that piece is maybe something I need to work on a little bit, just like getting some perspective and like taking a step back and saying, is that even something that I want? And even if it is, like, why do I want it? You know, I'm like, I just really want to be able to shell out whatever it costs to get the best haircut in New York City, which is so expensive. Why do I need the best haircut in New York City? So that piece is definitely the less healthy piece.
Yeah, that's really good. So let's wrap up with this. Pretend like 20 years from now, I'm still doing the show.
Mm-hmm.
And you're 46.
Yeah.
And I ask you about Lindsay, age 46, Lindsay. What does money mean to you? How do you hope you would answer 20 years from now?
I hope that, yeah, I think the first word that comes to mind is a tool. I think that's maybe a little almost overused, but I just hope that at that point it feels like I'm not constantly left wanting for more, but sort of settled in, like just generally like grateful and be able to use it of like, hey, you know, my kid wants to go on this trip with their friends. It's a tool for us to allow him to have that experience. Or like, I broke the car window. I hope that it's not extremely stressful for me to go fix the car window. One thing I worry about is being sad that I didn't reach a certain lifestyle that maybe my good friends now or my siblings will reach. So I just hope that I'm not comparing myself to my siblings or to my close friends. I hope that I'm like, you know what, this is great, even if it looks different from somebody else. Like, I just hope that it feels comfortable.
It's amazing, Lindsay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure, love you.
Love you too.
That was so fun for me. And the thing I want to point to is how much you can learn, even from the people you thought you knew best, about their experience with money by just asking questions, simple questions. My hope with 50 Fires is that it will encourage more meaningful conversations about money. And what I'm finding is all I have to do is set aside my own concerns, my own worries about the mistakes I may have made, and just be curious about another human being. I know of no other subject that can get you to what really matters to people faster than money. What do I want in the future? What are my hopes and my dreams? What are the things that keep me up at night? What are the things that wake me up in the morning because I'm so excited? And it was so fun and rewarding. And frankly, I feel sort of honored that Lindsay would allow me to have this kind of conversation with her. So what if the next time you had a spare moment, a few minutes with one of your kids or a friend or a spouse or a partner, what if you just ask them and start with something easy? And look, I'll even script it exactly. Hey, Sam, you know, I was wondering, I never really asked you, what's your first memory of money? And then just listen. One question that's quickly become one of my favorites is, what socioeconomic class were you in junior high? And the stories have been fascinating. So there's two simple ideas for you to have a conversation with a friend, a spouse, and maybe specifically with a child if you've got children, to see what their experience has been around money. Because if we can practice that, if we can teach our children that it's safe to talk about money, what other conversations will we start having? So until next time, I'm so glad you joined me for this conversation about money and meaning with my daughter, Lindsay Richards, on 50 Fires. Cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start 1 million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com, and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start 1 million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.